having Joel McCower appear in your podcast is, in the clean tech world, akin to Oprah landing Harry and Meghan. Like Harry and Meghan, Joel is a celebrity in our world. Everyone wants to hear what he has to say. And of course, he provides salacious details about the royal family. Okay, maybe not the royal stuff, but the rest is true. As the founder and CEO of Greenbiz, a media events company that lives, works, and leads at the intersection of the business technology and sustainability world, Joel is privy to the discussions, debates, policies, and business outcomes that are driving our clean energy economy. Today on Raising Your Antenna, Joel and I explore how the business community is attacking climate change, how the investment community really sees ESG as an opportunity for both good and profit, the strength of our commitment towards a net zero future, and of particular interest to me, the failure of corporate America to properly market their sustainability wins. Back with Joel and the time it takes for my beloved Baltimore Orioles to be eliminated from the pennant race.
You're listening to Raising Your Antenna with host Keith Sackheim.
Good afternoon. Welcome, Joel McCower, to Raising Your Antenna. It's a pleasure to have Joel, who is one of the more renowned names in the clean tech industry, having been in and about the space for more than 30 years. So, Joel, welcome aboard.
Thanks, Keith. It's a pleasure to be here.
And Joel, just quick perusal of your LinkedIn resume. You've had quite a career. I know you've been a journalist and a public speaker, one that people try to get much sought after public speaker at conferences. You've been an advisor to startups and businesses in the clean energy space. And of course, you are the chairman and a founder and CEO of the Greenbiz Group, which is, for me, a must-read website addressing all the most important topics of the day related to the clean tech, clean energy economy, sustainability, environment, and all that good stuff. So, Joel, again, if you can kind of give us a sense of what that career journey was like, what inspired you to get from point A to where you are today?
Yeah, well, thanks, Keith. Yeah, I've never quite figured out whether I am a journalist cursed with an entrepreneurial streak or an entrepreneur cursed with a journalistic streak, but somewhere in the middle of that is where I sit. I've actually co-founded three companies, all in the sort of information services arena. And yeah, I mean, I began my career as a freelance magazine writer, but actually pulled back a little bit. I became a journalist, not necessarily because I wanted to be a journalist, but because I frankly didn't have a clue what I wanted to be if I grew up. And my hypothesis at the time, this is in college, was that at least being a journalist or studying journalism would give me an opportunity to poke around and ask people questions and learn as much as I could about what was going on out there in the real world. And through that, I might find something that I was good at and interested in and synced with my lifestyle and values and all that kind of stuff. And for the first 15 or so years, what I was good at and, you know, synced with all those things was simply sticking my nose in other people's business and writing about it and asking questions and learning. When I was in journalism school, and this is going to date me, there were two important things going on in the world for me. One was Watergate. The journalists, you know, Woodward and Bernstein and a bunch of others as truth tellers and digging up the dirt. And the other was Ralph Nader, the Nader's Raider, Ralph Nader, not the election spoiler later that he became, but sort of every man as someone who could confront companies and help people find their way through this very complex marketplace that we have. And those are interesting to me. So I sort of wanted to become a consumer journalist. And I quickly realized that in order to write about consumer issues, you really had to understand business. And that sort of became my focus. And so I had a book idea, wrote a book on the health effects of office environments. This is 1981, which was pretty early on, but they were simply at that time sealing up offices and rethinking them after some indoor air quality things. And they're introducing computers and synthetics. And it was becoming a problematic area. If those of a certain age will remember a movie that came out at the time called 9 to 5 with Lily Tomlin and Jane Fonda and Dolly Parton that sort of captured the moment of office workers as sort of factory workers of the future. And so along the way in 1989, I got asked to create the US edition of a British bestseller called The Green Consumer Guide. I looked at it and realized that you couldn't simply Americanize the British edition. You really had to write a whole new book because the US audience is very different. And a book came out in 1990 during the very big media event that was Earth Day back then. Planet and Earth was on the cover of every magazine. Magazines, for those of you who are younger, were these big papery blogs kind of thing that we used to get in the mail. My book came out, The Green Consumer, and it was a bestseller. And I was very quickly had a weekly syndicated column in about 100 newspapers called The Green Consumer. And was preaching the gospel that every time you open your wallet, you cast a vote for or against the environment. And it's not a democracy. It doesn't take 51% of people voting. A small number of people can make a big difference. And then I very quickly realized two things. First, there was no real green consumer movement in the US. I looked over my shoulder and realized I was kind of standing there by myself. I later quipped that there may have been a reason that my book was titled The Green Consumer. I don't know who that was. It probably wasn't me.
That's good.
But number two was that the companies I was being asked to come in and talk to about the so-called consumer movement were themselves grappling with a lot of issues around energy and waste and toxics and emissions and of all sorts. And they needed help. And that was pretty interesting. So I started in 1991, a monthly newsletter, an 8-page, what we now call a dead tree snail mail newsletter called the Green Business Letter. And sort of things went on from there. So I'm old enough to say the sentence. And then the web came along and I created this website called greenbiz.com. And that later became this media and events company that you referenced, Green Biz Group. We're 45 people strong based here in Oakland, California. And we put on a bunch of big events. We have the media newsletters and website that you referenced and a membership group of sustainability executives from very big companies that we bring together as sort of a peer-to-peer learning network. So sorry, that's a long question to a short answer, but that's the story.
Fantastic. So, you know, let's start with the net zero movement and specifically the global net zero goal of 2050, which was only 29 years away. When I tell my kids 29 years away, for them, it's, you know, an eternity. But you know, I'm 46. 29 years ago does not seem that far. So 29 years away doesn't seem that far either. Mm-hmm. So it's an ambitious goal, and it asks entities, governments, corporations to both meaningfully reduce emissions and also balance the remaining emissions with sinks or removals. And to meet this goal, they're going to need to be massive behavioral shifts that will impact our day-to-day lives, at least in the short term. When 61% of countries have committed to that net zero emissions goal, only 20%, though, of the 2,000 largest public companies have done the same. At least that's the most recent study I had found or research I had found. As someone like yourself, who's intimately involved in these conversations within the business community, why is it that there's not more widespread adoption of this commitment? And what has to change in order for that to happen?
Yeah, it's a great question, Keith. I mean, like so many things in this field that seems simplistic or relatively straightforward, renewable energy, net zero, zero waste, circular economy, they're anything but. They're incredibly complex. And it turns out I wrote a piece back in March called The Coming Net Zero Backlash, and then another piece in June called The Net Zero Backlash Has Arrived. Like so many things, they, you know, once they become a trend and a meme and a movement, they often get used or misused or abused in terms of how they're being talked about. So the goal is we have to stop greenhouse gas emissions. And to do that, there's lots of different ways to do that by renewable energy, efficiency, all kinds of business innovations, even business model innovations. Then there's the hard to abate emissions, the things that are just really hard to control. And those are things that you need to offset, at least in the short term, by planting trees or any number of other things. The problem is that so many companies have gone right to the offsets. And it's a hierarchy. You need to reduce your emissions, use more green energy, and then offset the rest. And people go right to offsets. And so in other words, companies in particular are spending more time talking about net than talking about zero. They're talking about how do we balance out? The planet doesn't care that it's net, because if you're still emitting, even if you're offsetting it somewhere else, you're still pumping more greenhouse gases in the atmosphere. That's something we can't continue to do. So this has become a very thorny issue. And companies, I think, have pulled back in making these commitments, and at least some. I mean, there's a lot of talk about who still talk about net zero, and net zero is, there's net zero water use, net zero land use. There's all, net zero has become quite the meme in my field. I guess the shorter answer is that companies are still trying to grapple with how to think about this and message it and talk about it in a way, both internally and externally, upstream to their suppliers, which is one big part, and then downstream. And that's the supply chain is a huge piece of this. Most companies have grappled and successfully with how do they reduce emissions in along around their what they call the fence line, in the things they control, their facilities, maybe some of their processes, their offices, maybe their vehicle use, maybe even their employee commutes. Those things are a lot more countable and trackable and able to reduce or offset. But most companies overwhelmingly, and if you take the top 15 sectors, probably 13 of those, more than 80% and probably upwards of 90% of their emissions don't happen in their fence line. They happen in their supply chains. And that's much, much harder to control. And so that's another reason why this has become far more complex. And you're seeing a lot of articles, not just mine, but others in the mainstream media sort of starting to question these strategies and are they really good? One last thing, and then I'll stop, is that the goal of 2050 of net zero, which is what most companies have made, and some have made 2040 or 2035 or even 2030, but most are around, and the national goals tend to be around 2050. You know, that's 30 years from now. And to your point, Keith, that seems a ways off, but really isn't. It is a ways off. And the CEOs who are making those commitments are not going to be running their companies, probably not even alive in most cases, in 2050. And so there's not a lot of accountability there. Yeah. And so, again, this has just become really fraught and complex. And I think it's a good thing that it is, because it's really forcing more accountability and discipline to a lot of these commitments that companies have made, some of which may be kind of fast and loose.
Yeah. And I think that's a really interesting point about, you know, the CEOs and the C-suite today and some of these companies. Forget about like thinking about 30 years down the road. I mean, what the markets have kind of expected now is them to only think about a quarter down the road. And that has impact, not just when it comes to net zero, but in general infrastructure investment, and all the types of things and investments companies have to do to make sure they're staying ahead of the curve 10 years from now. They're loath to do that because of the pressure to show numbers each quarter. I would say also the public sector faces a very similar accountability problem where, you know, you have, again, these perverse incentives to only worry about the next election cycle, whether it's 2 years, 4 years, or maybe sometimes for governor, 6 years. And all these strategic decisions you have to make and invest in infrastructure investment decisions one has to make that won't bear fruit for decades, or maybe even just a decade, becomes totally irrelevant to their main incentive, which is to win the next election. So that is, unfortunately, that's why typically, I think it was Rahm Emanuel said to Bill Clinton, never waste a crisis, right? So like within-
yeah, never let a good crisis go to waste.
And right, he, never let it, exactly. He invented
that quote, but it's attributed to him, but yeah.
Yeah. And that type of, and the reason why that's true is because that's when long-term priorities become near-term and short-term priorities and then people have to respond.
Yeah, and we Americans are notorious for that short-term thinking. If you go to Europe and you go to Asia, that longer-term vision is a lot more prevalent and thinking a lot more about multi-generationally, not just multi-quarter, multi-year, but multi-generationally. And in the case of the Chinese and Japanese and others, it's much even broader than that, longer than that. So this is an American phenomenon that we're thinking about the next quarter, not exclusively, but primarily.
Yeah, no, agreed. I think this dovetails nicely into the next topic I wanted to address, which is what is commonly referred to as ESG, so environment, social, and governance, and kind of the mandate that companies have now to invest in, again, what's called ESG. And let's drill down a little bit first into the environment piece. So, you know, ESG as a value, I guess, emerged only after the business community began to see their responsibility as not only incorporating shareholders, as Milton Friedman famously contended, but broader stakeholders. So employees being a stakeholder, neighbors being a stakeholder, environment being a stakeholder, local and global communities being stakeholders. And at least so the economic imperative of corporate America has at least been dulled a little bit by this new commitment, both, you know, on a moral and social justice level to ESG. the S in ESG is social, and the social unrest of the past few years and kind of the ever widening disparities of wealth that's caused all societal stakeholders to re-examine their behaviors and commitments. So the business community pays a lot of, I don't want to say lip service, that sounds a little too cynical, but certainly has been vocal about their renewed commitment to the social and ESG, the environment and ESG. But can you comment on the overall paradigm shift within the business community? Again, I guess since your days of being a journalist, and I like how you kind of articulated that the best thing about journalism was being able to ask questions and kind of learn how business operates and take that into your career afterwards. This paradigm shift within the business community, and also how is it manifest in the day-to-day operations of corporate America? How will they operate differently?
Well, first of all, I still consider myself a journalist, and on my better days, I actually get to commit some journalism. You know, this ESG has become a phenomenon, and it sort of reminds me of that that quote from Hemingway about how did, you know, someone asked him, how did you go bankrupt? And he said, slowly, then suddenly. This ESG thing has been long in the making, and it really has its roots back in the social responsibility or socially responsible investing era that's been around for 20, 25, 30 years, depending when you start counting, which is, you know, taking into consideration other things besides simply quarterly financials and the bottom line, that there are other bottom lines, a social bottom line, environmental bottom line, and some other things that companies need to be considering. And by the way, companies that do consider these things tend to be more profitable, attract and retain talent, better equipped for innovation and risk reduction and all kinds of things. For a long time, then ESG is not a new phenomenon. It's been around for, I don't know, easily a decade, but it was sort of sitting off to the side. It was sort of a nice way to roll up environmental issues, social issues, and governance issues, which have been, again, around a long time, around board payment and diversity and executive compensation, not board payment, executive compensation, the role of board oversight, and all kinds of what are called governance issues. But in the last few years, they've found themselves sitting squarely on the corner of Broad and Wall Street in Lower Manhattan. And in other words, right in the center of the financial community, metaphorically speaking, where this has become a core interest of investors. And investors now equate companies with good ESG metrics and scores as better investments, lower risk, higher resilience to these incredibly changing and dynamic and unpredictable times. Better profitability and better ability to attract and retain talent, all the things that had been talked about for a long time. This rose from the environmental executive in a company, and all of a sudden the chief financial officer, investor relations, the corporate treasury, and ultimately the board of directors and the CEO are now engaged because the world's largest investors are leaning into these things, or at least on paper. And it's not a perfect thing. There's a lot of controversy around that as well. But the world's biggest investors, the BlackRocks and Fidelities and others, or State Street, are leaning into this and saying, we want to move our investments in these directions. We want to exercise our shareholder votes to encourage companies to do certain things and around climate and energy and a number of other issues, and social equity and social justice and things. And so there it is. Now, like so many things, and I'm going to keep repeating myself, this is not simple. It's not clean. There's no consensus yet on how companies should be reporting these things. Oh, and by the way, here in the United States, the Securities and Exchange Commission is soon to be putting out rules that are going to require companies to report at least some of these things publicly in their quarterly and annual financials, the way they now have to report their financials. And they're required to do it in a certain kind of way. So this is quickly becoming not a nice to do, but a must do. And all of a sudden, when your biggest investors are saying, how are you doing on these scores? And what can you tell us about your performance and your plans? That gets everyone's attention. As I said, we have a membership group of chief sustainability officers from big companies, companies with more than $1 billion in revenue. They say, you know, we never got invited to investor meetings between our investor relations department and our largest investors, the pension funds and the institutional investors and asset owners and managers that own our stock. Now they're getting asked 10, 20, 30 times a year to sit in on those meetings. That's a huge change and a huge paradigm shift in how business is thinking about these things. How this actually changes business behavior is TBD. Just reporting information, even if it's good information, does not necessarily guarantee that the changes we all want to see in the world or that we need to see in the world of business are actually going to happen. And so that's another story altogether.
Actually, I'm interested in your perspective on this ESG scorecards and the kind of metrics businesses and I guess key performance indicators that businesses will be asked to submit versus, you know, whether those metrics really are indicative of a company being serious about ESG.
It's all over the map.
I know, for example, like as a marketing agency, so we've had three companies now come to us who have the greatest SaaS solution for companies to go input their key metrics and spit out reports that are going to make the case that they're on the right side of ESG. So just curious in terms of what you're seeing and hearing from the corporate community.
Look, I have deep respect for the marketing and communications professions, public relations, and all the other things that companies like Antenna Group do, Keith. But a lot of companies turn to companies like you and not necessarily saying these words, or maybe saying these words like, make us look good. And sometimes it's appropriate because they are good and they want to tell their story. And sometimes it's less direct that they're not really where they want to be. And how do you spin it in a way and talk about the few good things you can talk about and play those up and maybe sweep the others under the hypothetical metaphorical rug. And so I think this is where a lot of us, journalists, activists, investors, employees, community members struggle is we see these commitments, these report outs, progress reports, these seemingly profound CEO quotes and speeches. And we say, wow, this is a real transformation taking place. And there is. But how much and how fast, and is it happening at the scale, scope, and speed that's required to take on these incredibly important and even existential issues? Probably not so much. And so simply reporting about stuff is good. Transparency is important, and that, you know, what gets measured gets managed, all that good stuff. But it's not the be-all, end-all. And so companies traditionally, they've been putting out sustainability reports for 25 or more years, some companies even more than that. And they often view these things as sort of the end of a process. Yay, we did the report, we got all the data, we published it, it's out there in the world. But it's really the beginning of a process saying, okay, now that we've done this, what did we learn? What didn't we know? Where were the information gaps, things we should know but don't yet know? And now that we look at where we are and where we need to go, how are we doing on that trajectory? And should we be doing more? And what changes do we need to make beyond the ones we've already committed to? That doesn't happen enough.
Yeah, yeah. And I'm going to segue now into kind of another topic I wanted to address with you, also related to ESG. And any kind of fledgling movement needs to promote the good actors as opposed to the bad actors, because what happens is that the good actors get enough, you know, currency and enough benefit from being a good actor in that marketplace, then others will follow and there'll be a copycat type of phenomenon. And within ESG and sustainability and circular economy and net zero commitments, the reality is that even though the private sector has lagged somewhat and the media is always excited to talk about the laggards, there are still hundreds of companies that are doing really, really important things. And the common denominator among all of them is that they don't market their success as well. We hear a lot more about greenwashing than we do about credible greening. And marketing, obviously, is near and dear to my heart, as you mentioned. And what's interesting is, you know, we're the largest kind of clean energy focused marketing communications agency in North America. But really, the vast majority of our clients are on the technology side, and our mandate is to promote their solutions. Very few companies have come to us with the ask to message and market their sustainability successes and wins. So why is that, first of all? Because these companies all have impressive comms people. And you know, I don't know if the reason is because there's some bottleneck between communications and C-suite or why they may not understand as a priority. So A is why, and then B is, you know, how do we change it?
Yeah, this is an issue that's been going on for a long time. And to a large extent, and you may not want to hear this, Keith, I don't know that they should be talking about some of these things, you know, any more than you should talk about safety. I mean, we have safety in our factory floor. Well, yeah, of course you should. But one of the challenges here is that companies are, this is an area in sustainability and clean technology and all these things where companies are actually walking more than they're talking. They're doing more than they're saying. And that's a challenge. And one of the reasons is that this stuff is really hard to talk about without getting yourself into trouble. Here's a story that goes back a number of years. I once heard that Levi Strauss at the time was the largest cotton buyer in the world, had started sourcing 2% of their annual cotton buy organically. And you don't have to be a journalist to say, hey, that's pretty interesting. That's a story. I called them and they said, nah, we don't want to talk about it. And I persevered. And over time, I knew people there and worked the system, finally got them to talk with me about it. And one of the questions I asked them was, why didn't you want to talk about it? And they said, well, look at it from our perspective. When we go out and tell the story, first of all, we have to explain how hard cotton is to grow and the incredible inputs of toxic, pesticides and fertilizers and the environmental impacts of groundwater runoff and worker health and safety and the birds and the trees. We risk our customers saying, so you mean 98% of what you buy is bad for people and the planet?
Yeah.
Why only 2%? Why not 5%?
The truth
we're
going
to do boycotts right. until you commit to 10% organic cotton.
Right. And the truth is, you know what? That's a fair criticism in general, the environmental movement over the years. Very often companies that are trying, they let the perfect get in the way of the good constantly. So yeah, that makes sense.
I've often said that environmental activists need to learn how to say 5 words to companies when companies have these kinds of commitments and achievements. Thank you. Now do more. They'll definitely say the last three. That's not good enough.
Exactly.
But they never say, that's great. Thank you for doing that. We really appreciate it. We want to see you do more. And what happens is that the people inside those companies who struggle sometimes for years to make incremental improvements against all odds and maybe fighting their own bureaucracies, let alone the suppliers and others who had to be involved with making these changes, not only get no credit for it, but they get pushback from the activists who say, that's not good enough. And management executives say, why do we even bother with this stuff? Or why do we even bother talking about it? And so they don't talk about it. Because when you talk about what you're doing right, you often illuminate problems that the public didn't know you had. Cotton, who knew? And so that's one big challenge. And so a lot of companies
I think there's one other thing that I think the environmental activist community misses is they misunderstand the temperament of Americans. The country typically is willing to move in a more progressive direction, but with incremental wins. Politicians who try to move too quickly constantly lose in this country. Movements that try to move too quickly and try to take radical shifts in one direction or the other lose. It's those movements that take the incremental wins, build on those, and take another incremental win. That typically is how movements, certainly progressive movements in this country, are able to succeed. And I do think that the environmental movement actually is starting to learn that lesson. And that's why we've seen, I think, significant progress over the last decade or decade and a half. And I hope it continues.
Yeah. I mean, you need both the carrots and the sticks. You need the big, hairy, audacious goals, and you need the speed, we need the pressure to keep on to do more faster because time is short and the problems are significant. But you need to celebrate success. You need to give credit where credit's due and don't let anybody rest on their laurels. And I think, and by the way, and I'm not speaking about Antenna here at all. I know you're one of the better firms, but there's a lot of PR firms who just don't know how to talk about this stuff. I can't tell you how many press pitches we get in our company that start off with it's easy being green, or you can do good and do well. Just these things that are like, shoot me now. Like they immediately disqualify from reading even the next sentence, let alone the next paragraph.
comment on my side.
Yeah. I'm sure you've seen a bunch of it too. And they're doing the bidding of their clients, and that's understandable. But the state of the art has not changed all that much.
Yeah, no, I think that's a fair criticism. Although I know, we've been doing this now for about 15 years, and the level of communications professional that we're able to hire today versus 15 years ago is just you can't compare the two. The domain expertise is so much more impressive now, and when you have kind of these new industries that emerge, comms people first have to learn it and work in it before they can actually be effective comms people. And yeah. I think because the industry has matured so much, level of professionalism, competency, and domain expertise of a clean tech comms professional today is fantastic. But I totally hear the criticism, and we always internalize that, and we want to make sure that we're sensitive to a journalist, the media that we're pitching. We don't be wasting their time. We understand that they have a lot on their plate as well. So Joel, thank you so much. This was a fantastic conversation. And as we always do on Raising Your Antenna, would love for you, you have a platform to raise any kind of issue or topic that we didn't get to today that you think for a couple minutes you really want to articulate. That's A. And then B, if you can give, a book recommendation or two for our listeners.
Well, there's so much to talk about. We could do, 10 of these and still not cover everything. We publish 7 weekly newsletters. They're all free. And some of them cover energy, the circular economy, ESG and sustainable finance, transportation and mobility, climate tech, all the things we've been talking about and more. And it's hard to keep up with it all. And I think it's really important that we talk about the controversy about net zero and offsets and emissions and ESG and all that. There is just an extraordinary amount of exciting stuff going on. I've been in this field, as you said, for over 30 years, and I wake up every day just excited about what's going on out there and concerned about, again, the pace of change and the scale and scope and speed of change. Are we doing enough? But there is just it's really an extraordinary field. And this is at a really extraordinary time right now, because frankly, the world is catching up to where we've been for a long, long time and saying we need to be doing this stuff. Yeah, this is no longer nice to do. This is what's going to be required for companies. And, talk to companies and they say, think about your most demanding customer when it comes to sustainability. They want, this kind of packaging or this kind of metrics or report outs or any things that they want about the product or the way it's delivered or the business model or anything else. Think about your most demanding customer. In the next 2 to 5 years, that's going to be your mainstream customer. Things are changing so quickly that I think it's really in a very, very exciting way. So I just encourage, despite the challenges, despite the problems that we've talked about, there is, I don't think, a more exciting or much more exciting field right now to be in than in sustainability, clean tech, climate tech, and all of that.
I emphatically agree with that.
I just read the Ministry of the Future by Kim Stanley Robinson. I haven't read sci-fi since college. I'm not a big sci-fi guy, but this is a book about climate change. It takes place somewhere in the 30s, 40s, and 50s. You can get through the first chapter, which is really brutal, about a disastrous heat wave in India. It's really interesting. The Ministry of the Future refers to as the nickname of a UN agency, a fictional UN agency, that was created by the United Nations, the whole climate mechanism there, to advocate for future generations. And as this protagonist, the head of this agency, travels around the world trying to do all these things, it's pretty interesting. And at the same time, the world is suffering from climate change. Things are getting really, really bad. And it's a fascinating look into where we are. And I really, if you have any appetite for it, I would strongly encourage you to read it.
Great. I will definitely do that. I study with somebody every Friday morning for about an hour, and he's a huge consumer of science fiction. So I would let him know about it. Maybe I'll let him read it first. And then if he gives me the thumbs up, I'll dive into it. But anyway, Joel, thank you so much again. It was a pleasure having you on Raising Your Antenna. Good luck with the rest of the year. And I hope to see you on the conference circuit soon once we all start traveling and seeing each other in person again.
Oh my God, I so look forward to that, Keith.
All right, take care.
And another episode of Raising Your Antenna is in the books. I hope you enjoyed today's episode. Raising Your Antenna is a podcast hosted by yours truly, Keith Zackheim, that features the movers and shakers and key influencers of the B2B technology industry. Our guests are leading revolutions and disruptions in the mobility, clean energy, healthcare, and real estate technology industries. Raising Your Antenna is brought to you by Antenna Group, a full-service digital marketing and public relations agency that focuses on the B2B technology industry. Please be in touch with me on Twitter at @CZackheim with any feedback about this podcast. And check out Antenna Group at www.antennagroup.com if your organization is looking for a really smart and good-looking marketing and public relations partner.